Welcome, everyone. I'm Andrew Thompson, General Manager of CFMG Capital, and welcome to another episode of Smart Capital. Each month, we sit down with an expert to explore a topic that impacts investors and delivers practical insights to help you on your journey to financial freedom. In this episode, we're going to take a closer look at the Perth property market, including what has happened recently, what is driving activity, and where opportunities may emerge over the short, medium, and long term. Here at CFMG Capital, we established an office in Perth last year and we're currently investigating a number of opportunities for future development. So it's a market we're following with considerable interest and learning along the way. So joining me is an expert from Perth, Trent Fleskins, who's Managing Director of Perth Strategic Property Group. Trent is a property strategist and market commentator with deep knowledge of the Perth market and the factors shaping investment and development decisions across WA in particular and Australia more broadly. Welcome, Trent.
Okay, Andrew, how are you going?
Good, good. And welcome to the Smart Capital.
Thank you. Looking forward to a good chat about my favourite part of the world.
So I guess we'll just jump right into it. As I sort of outlined, we've got a really strong interest in Perth, expanding our business over there 12 months ago, working diligently to establish opportunities and not just jumping right in. But I guess just try to give listeners a really good clear snapshot of the market and what's driving activity over there. So I guess just give us a bit of a, what's the Perth property market been doing over the last 12 to 24 months or even longer, maybe since COVID?
Well, I think it's important to go back even further, Andrew, and have a conversation about what Perth is doing when no one was talking about Perth, when all the East Coast money would never even consider Perth. That was a time from 2016 onwards where for a good five-year period, Perth's markets was in the doldrums, and that was simply because we'd built too many homes for the amount of people that had come and then left. A lot of people left after the mining boom, and we just had a big surplus of properties that no one needed to live in. And therefore, we had our longest and deepest property downturn ever. That started to show some green shoots in 2019. The bottom of the market was March 2019, before COVID, a year before really COVID kicked in, and that had been obviated by the stock on market number of 17,000 properties, which is the most properties we've ever had on the market at one time in Perth. A balanced market has 13,000. COVID in Perth, like the rest of the country, obviously kicked in a lot of cheap debt and a lot of requirement for housing with people coming home from other parts of the world, and then continued with record levels of immigration. 2021 had more immigration to Perth than the 5 years before that put together. And that just continued every year with similar numbers that we haven't been able to build for. So we soaked that supply up within a year after COVID. And then we've been in essentially a deficit of housing supply ever since, continually bringing in more people, both internationally and domestically, than we've got the capacity to build for. We actually have a lower capacity to build housing in this state than we did 10 years ago with about 30% more people, which is unbelievable to think about, but therein lies a great example of our lack of productivity. And so when you have more people needing a basic need of shelter and less ability per person to fix that problem, like any asset class where demand growth is greater than supply growth, prices go up. And so prices have had the most space to go up in the country, in Perth, given how far back we started and also the fact we have the highest incomes in the country other than in Canberra. And we still have the most fat for growth in addition to a market that still has half of a balanced market worth of stock available at any one time for sale. So that journey has led to prices increasing on average by 90% since COVID, and some suburbs being at more like 160%, obviously some at more like 50, which is why you've got a median across the city. The winners and losers have really come down to either a change in amenity, improvement in amenity for those particular suburbs or affordability. And in some cases where the East Coast migration of investors has focused.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds a fairly similar story what's been going on with Queensland, and that certainly since COVID, not so much prior to COVID, but in what we've seen in Queensland in particular, but also in other markets we operate, but mainly in Queensland, it's the same thing. It's that supply and demand imbalance that's just seen almost, in my opinion, unsustainable market growth in terms of pricing. But I guess my next question is, do you see any sort of difference in what's happening? I guess if you're looking between what we call existing real estate versus new development, are you seeing sort of a two-tiered pace of growth, or is it just coming down purely to location? Or is there a little bit of new versus old as well?
In Western Australia, the segmentation of growth recently in the last 7 or 8 months, really this calendar year, has come down to investor stock versus owner-occupied stock. Investor stock has pulled back even before the budget, but certainly after the budget, simply as the East Coast has, had some tremors in their markets. And when you're a bit nervous about your own backyard, you probably aren't putting the same pressure on the West Australian market as you would have before. The owner-occupied market obviously represents West Australian money, and there's a lot of money in Western Australia, a lot of people with big savings levels, lots of equity in their homes who are trading up as well. So suburbs that are blue chip, that have lower levels of investor stock, are holding up really well, are doing really well still, and suburbs that have been saturated by investors, and especially East Coast investors, have been the ones that have probably pulled back about 10% since the budget.
And are you seeing in those sort of owner occupiers that have got large amount of equity, are they largely seeking to trade up as opposed to access the equity to invest in their own markets?
Since the budget, they're trading up a lot because one, we've got more stock available to do so, more options for the first time. We only had 1,800 properties available on the market at Christmas for a whole state. So there was just no mobility, no options. People were simply buying for shelter rather than for amenity. Now there are more options with 7,000 properties on the market. And so people are using that to start having a look around to see what they possibly can upsize to or downsize to, where they haven't had that option for the last 3 years. And investor space is really one where it is dominated by yield, ours being higher than most capital cities, if not all, other than, well, Darwin's, and affordability. I think at the moment, the big thing that's impacting the investor space is simply the interest rate reality for investors.
Yeah. And I know, like, I was in Perth and sort of caught up with you about a month ago. And I know probably one of the other big differences between the WA market and Southeast Queensland in particular is the lack of apartment stock, or, you know, not a lot of apartments getting built, not a lot of demand for apartments in that part of the world. Is that
That's exactly what it is. I mean, the cost structure, I can't imagine, is very different between Perth and Brisbane. But Brisbane can make it work because there is significant demand, or sufficient demand for it, to the extent that they can therefore achieve the prices they need to make an apartment development stack up. And that is for two reasons. One, you've got less space to move, I guess, in Southeast Queensland, and less broadacre land opportunities than Perth. And so people just have to move into apartments. Two, I'd say the Brisbane market's probably 15, 20 years ahead of Perth's. And Perth will simply be there in 15, 20 years in terms of that cultural acceptance of apartment living. And probably a third bonus one is Brisbane's planning system is far more progressive with regards to allowing apartment zoning in high amenity areas around your river. Whereas in Perth, our river is highly protected by larger quarter acre, half an acre blocks, where more of the mansions of Perth get those private views. And so you can't really, there is, you know, you lack in Perth a lot of riverfront views, ocean views. We just don't have ocean views because they're all low density mansions that dominate that space. Whereas you look at a Gold Coast, for example, and the biggest selling point is you can see out to Fiji. There isn't an apartment on the ocean in Perth that's been built for 40 years. That's because there's a small couple of small ones coming in now. But that is mainly because of local planning NIMBYism.
Yeah, it's amazing. If a Brisbane local to hear that we've got a progressive planning system would be shocking to some people's ears, but the grass is not always greener.
I think it's different. Like Perth's planning system, I think, is renowned for being far more efficient, but culturally, it is still very anti-apartments. It is still very, you know, we're talking about things like overlooking. We're talking about things like overshadowing. If we aren't squeaky clean on that, which is nearly impossible for an apartment building, then it's very hard to get approved. And so unless it's already in a designated apartment space, which is few and far between in most local governments, then you're not going to get an approval. And even then, most apartments don't stack up at the height limits that are provided for. And so every application essentially needs to be begging for discretion on height, which means that they're normally giving up XYZ in public space or spending XYZ in extra architectural features to keep the council happy and making it uneconomic in the first place. So we just don't have an industry for apartments, really. There's less than 10 apartment builders in Perth because there just isn't that many opportunities and there aren't that many people that want to buy them.
Yeah, a combination of, yeah, the lack of demand as well as the planning as well as the people seeking to build them. So the triple whammy, I guess.
Yeah.
And while you've seen sort of a softening of the market, particularly post-budget, are you seeing that as a result, a yield sort of holding true, vacancy rates are probably dropping even?
Rents are going up. I mean, it's no surprise to everyone. You're not Nostradamus to be saying that rents would have gone up after the budget. And this is not really even a reality of the budget. It's a reality of the sentiment from the budget because the budget hasn't even really kicked in yet in a way. So that's a next year thing. It's simply just less people are now already going and buying investment properties. But over time, you go in to see that reality filter through, that there will just be less investment properties available in many of the established areas in Perth, and they will saturate on the urban fringes where there is still negative gearing benefits, and they can those benefits, you know, can be enjoyed if not just sold by property investment spruikers, consultants.
Yeah.
And therefore rents will clearly skyrocket in the leftover rental properties in the established areas because they aren't making any more of them.
Yeah, those blue chip suburbs or even just the non sort of growth areas or what I call like new development areas, there'll be less and less rentals available because it's not attractive for investors anymore. So the rents will skyrocket in those areas while, the young renters will be pushed out into the suburbs because that's the only place there'll be rental properties available. I guess, moving on from, we've sort of already moved on to outlook a little bit, but, you know, we've talked about the Perth property market in the rearview mirror. I guess what's your outlook for Perth prices, rents, or just general transaction activity in the next 6 to 12 months and beyond?
Look, for a bit of context, pre-COVID, we had the lowest transaction numbers per person ever. Now we're sitting about 500 to 550 transactions a week. Post-COVID, with a number of incentives, the building grants and all that came through, WA had a doubling up of that. We were seeing 1,000 transactions a week for a couple of years, then moderated to 900, between 900 and 800 until the start of the year. And then from the budget, that number dropped down into the 600s, which we haven't seen since COVID. And that is really just removing the investor portion of demand out of that market for a period. And the last 3 weeks, we've seen that bounce back up into the mid-700s, which is encouraging. It means that sentiment people starting to think about other things and get worried about other things again and get on with their life and buy that property, invest in that property. So we are seeing a recovery of transactions. I'd like to see that sit up back around the early 800s every week, and we're hopefully moving back towards that, it looks like. With regards to growth, look, last year we pulled another 20% year, which is not sustainable, and it's not very helpful for the economy and productivity generally, but it happened, and we were expecting maybe a low teens this year. I think that number is probably going to be more like 5 to 8%, of which most of it was in the first quarter of the year. My expectation in Perth is that in Perth, the median price will probably just go sideways for a while until interest rates invariably or inevitably drop because of how weak the Sydney and Melbourne economy and markets are. And that's essentially what determines interest rates, and to a lesser extent, Queensland. Certainly the Perth market and Perth economy is irrelevant in that space. Rates will drop when Perth's economy is booming. So we'll benefit from that. It'll be a sugar hit, and then you'll start to see prices rise based simply on increased serviceability for young people. So when I say that we'll have a 5 to 8% rise, that meant that probably half the market had growth and half the market saw arbitrarily prices go backwards, and that would have been investor saturated suburbs. And then next year, month to month, I don't think we're going to see too much growth across the board until we see rate drops, and then rate drops will be that thing that changes the sentiment, provides that idea, you know, that energy for opportunity, and the fundamentals of Perth, which continue to be an undersupply, where we can't build enough for the people that are coming to this state, will then essentially be able to affect the price growth they should be. Remember, price growth inevitably should occur when demand growth is higher than supply growth, but it gets modulated by sentiment and by serviceability. So sentiment's low on the long-term scale, and serviceability is low, then even if you should have had growth of 10%, you might only see 2, simply because the market was dampening the impact of that demand-supply relationship. So that's what's going on right now in Perth. We should be seeing growth because we have half the properties on the market that a balanced market would have. But I don't think we're going to for the next few months, at least, because of sentiment and because rates are where they are.
Yeah, I mean, demand outstripping supply is one thing, but that demand has to be able to transact.
Yeah. And it has to be able to transact with relation to that relationship, right? So generally, yeah, if demand outstrips supply, you'll have a number of people negotiating on a property, and therefore prices get bidded up. But if those people can't afford because of interest rates or don't have the risk profile because of general market sentiment, they're just not going to show up, even though invariably they would need to buy that property. They'll just stay in the rental market where there's less risk, and then push rents up and yields up in the investor space.
Yeah. And you mentioned investor saturated areas. Is that how would you categorize an investor saturated area? Is that where new developments are going on, or is that more traditional suburb locations or traditional areas?
It's a bit of both, actually. I mean, you're always going to have in the new suburbs, you're always going to have a higher level of investor stock, because that's often the money that's getting these houses built in the first place, and then they'll often then transact a second, the first time after that, being new to an owner occupier, a first home buyer, right? So it starts to water that down a bit, as long as the suburb ends up being a good one. But to be frank, a lot of the investor level push in terms of growth has come from older established suburbs that a lot of West Australians wouldn't say is an attractive place to be. And most of that growth has come from East Coast investors looking at a map, being pushed by buyer's agents who have never been to the suburb, following the other buyer's agent on YouTube, and suddenly a suburb like Gosnells or Camillo or something like that is now worth double what it was 4 years ago when no amenity changes happened. There's no other reason to live there other than the yields look pretty good.
And is that something, I'm sort of loosely familiar with Gosnells, but is there a sense that in some cases fundamentals are overcoming sentiment? And what I sort of mean by that is, say if you went back 30 years in Sydney, Brisbane, Melbourne, for example, Sydney, you've got Redfern. Now, Redfern is immediately adjacent to CBD, but it was considered a low socioeconomic area. Something like Footscray in Melbourne.
No. There's no gentrification in those suburbs. Willoughby is a great example of gentrification, where Willoughby used to be a state housing dominated suburb. It's next to a fantastic suburb called Melville, and these are 15 Ks from the city. Willoughby's price has gone up 120% since COVID, one of the biggest growth suburbs in Perth, simply because it actually did gentrify. All the state housing went out to the fringes. It had a rezoning which allowed for development, which allowed for new housing, young people, and Melville was doing so well that Willoughby was just like, well, it has to come with it. So that's an example of what you're talking about, like a Redfern, which I am familiar with.
Yeah.
Gosnells has not changed its amenity at all. It really is no safer, no new facilities, didn't suddenly get closer to the river. What happened was thousands of Sydney and Melbourne investors got pushed there by YouTube people, and the herd migrated there and pushed prices up, to prophesizing in a way to double the suburb price. And Gosnells just has to hope all the investors from the East Coast don't decide to sell, because no one in Perth's buying them for that price. And that is what happens to Perth, or has happened to Perth for the first time.
And they probably won't sell because they'll give up their ability to negative.
Yeah, maybe that's what's locking them in. But for the first time since, obviously, social media and video walkthroughs, Perth is just so much more accessible and less risky in a way, because people can at least see a video of it. Whereas in the last boom, you didn't have Facebook, you didn't have FaceTime, you didn't have these ways. A lot of the data that comes through the RP data and that now that they can do reports on. And so now Perth's that more accessible. It has benefited in a way, if you want to call that, from multiples more interest from the East Coast than it did in the last boom, when it was performing just as well compared to the East Coast as it has now.
Yeah. So you do have examples of gentrification, but some of the areas you're talking about, it's just market mentality and that herd driven from the seminars and the spruiking.
Well, you see the same thing happening previously. Melbourne, it's the same thing. There's no fundamental reason to invest in Melbourne right now. The place is broke. It's a shambles. But you look at YouTube and everyone's saying, let's buy in Melbourne. Why? Because it's the easiest way for buyer's agents.
6 o'clock in the market. Yeah.
Well, why? Because it's the easiest way for buyer's agents to source property so they can get paid right now. It's so obviously conflicted. But there will always be enough people in that herd going, let's all jump in. And it will be self-prophesizing again. They'll all jump into the same three suburbs, bid each other up and go, hey, price growth. It's like, that's not price growth. That's you guys just bidding each other up on the same properties. So it's happened a bit in Perth.
Like stock manipulation.
Yeah, it is. It's a little bit of that. And so 5 to 10 suburbs in Perth, it happened. And, they were leaders of the pack, I guess. And then eventually the West Coast investors came in and invested in stock that, based on them finally having equity in their houses again, started investing in stock that I guess more reflected West Australians' personal views rather than what a map or a report might say.
But I guess the key sort of, I said relevant to, I guess, what we do, not trying to, conflate the two too much, but the key outtake of this is that we're still in a demand and supply imbalance. Those key fundamentals of supply not meeting demand are still there. But while there's other sort of market factors at play that will temper that sort of market growth you've experienced in the last 2 or 3 years a little bit to the short to medium term.
Perth is still the most undersupplied city in the country. It has half the amount of properties on the market than it does in a balanced market. It still has the most fat between its affordability index, so what people's mortgage disposable income is and the mortgage they pay in the whole country.
Median multiple,
Yeah, you call it that. We call it an affordability index. So we're still the furthest away from hitting a ceiling on that compared to somewhere like Sydney, which still demonstrates an undersupply in a lot of areas, but just keeps hitting that cap because of how expensive they are and the fact they make less than people in Perth, for example, right? So they're always fine. And that's why they're so sensitive to rates. So Perth has that going for it. And it has also, it just has the best economy by a long way. We've had multi-billion dollar surpluses since COVID every single year. And that gets fed into public projects that turn into jobs. And jobs mean wages, which means money, which means multipliers. So if you didn't know any of the suburbs in a certain area and you wanted to be an investor nationally, because that was your risk profile, and you're just throwing a dart at a board, there's only two cities that I'd be investing into. It's Perth for our economy, and it's Brisbane for the Olympics. That's it. If I didn't know, those are the places I'd personally be investing into if I didn't know much more than the median house price and a few headlines.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess both, particularly more so Brisbane, I guess that it's not just the international migration, it's the net interstate migration that we're seeing a lot of in Brisbane in particular. Not just because of the Olympics, but you mentioned Sydney before and median multiple or affordability index. Like if you're a nurse or a school teacher or a bank teller or lots of other sort of jobs that are consistent across the country, you're getting paid almost the same money no matter where you live.
But your mortgage is double in a place.
Your mortgage is five times in Sydney to live in a similar amenity.
That's exactly right. And you're right. Domestic immigration is a big factor, and Brisbane is experiencing the most of it, and Perth's experiencing the second most of it. And simply because we've got jobs, it's cheaper to live where we live.
Just a little bit too far away.
They're better places to live, to be honest.
Yep.
I mean,
yep.
I'm biased, but Perth and Brisbane, of all the cities I've been to, are the nicest places to be. And places like Melbourne are just less enjoyable, less safe places to be than they used to. So they're losing people every year. Sydney's losing them because they're so expensive. So there's a push-pull going on both sides.
So I guess talking about sort of employment, population, infrastructure trends, is there anything going on in that space? We'll talk about population, but employment and infrastructure.
AUKUS is the biggest thing since Chevron's $100 billion projects up north. AUKUS is going to be $32 billion, which for a place like Perth is like having a brand new gas plant built 25K south of the city. So there's a radius you draw around Garden Island, where our naval base is, where there's going to be thousands of defense and defense-related people having to move here and live. And you go, well, that wouldn't be a bad place to invest. It wouldn't be a bad place to hold an asset that people will need for a long time into the future using very price-insensitive government money.
Is there any corridors or precincts that you think might look materially different from a decade from now? I mean, my observations of Perth from my frequent visits in the last 18 months, is it a little bit like Southeast Queensland, where there's obviously a flow to the coastline? Brisbane is almost the center of a metropolis that extends from the bottom of the Gold Coast to up to Noosa these days. But if you drive 45 minutes straight west from any of those locations, you're in farmland.
That's the same. Perth is similar. Yeah. Perth, imagine the best part of the Gold Coast, Perth's whole coastline, West Australia's whole coastline is the Gold Coast, all the way.
What's better from what I've seen?
Better from Dunsborough all the way to Monkey Mia. It's the same, but better. There's no bad part in the West for some reason,
too many sharks, though.
Yeah, too many sharks, which is why I don't jump in. But which is why we have a 100-kilometer city that goes 100 kilometers north and only about 20 kilometers east.
Or
north and south, I should say, and 20 kilometers east. But that is also because we have a natural boundary, and that is the Darling Scarp. So we just have a big ridge line, 20-ish Ks from the city to the inland, that blocks us being able to build anywhere, you know, up from that. So everywhere east of that ridgeline, anywhere inland of that ridgeline, is this farmland for all the way to Kalgoorlie. So, yeah. So we are very much restricted by that. And then, you know, the coastal sands make it easier to build on sand dunes than it is to build on clay. We don't like building on clay. We don't build on stilts. Everything's concrete on sand. And so we, our land development side of things, very much prefers to stick to the soft sand.
Yeah. Sand would be easier to move than clay, that's for sure.
That's very true. And you've got to replace the clay with new sand. So it's just a lot cheaper to be building on the coast, and people would rather live on the coast. And generally that runs up and down where our established freeways are anyway. So yeah, that is our reality. People were just running up and down the coast, and then there's a wheel and spoke sort of going on in the southeast and northeast as well, which is just lower cost options in a similar vein.
And I guess from a infrastructure, is there sort of much investment in public transport infrastructure you're seeing?
Well, we've just spent of train lines. $14 billion on a thing called MetroNet, which is about five times more than we've spent on hospitals in the last 7 years. So we've essentially built another, like we've essentially doubled our rail line in the last, or since the Labor government's come in. They called it MetroNet, and it's connected a lot of the newer estates to the city and to the airport. We built an airport line in the last few years as well. And that obviously has been built as a forward-thinking infrastructure for future development that will be happening in between as well, and somewhat to left and right of the railway line. So,
and so yeah, in simple terms, you've obviously got a strong north-south main line, and what MetroNet is that just expansion, little tentacles off that? Is that what
entailed? Been a bit of a ring line, yeah, sort of connecting the southwest and the southeast line. There's been an extension of the southeast line. There's been a massive extension of the northeast, pretty much a creation of the northeast line. And then there's been a tunnel to the airport. I mean, that in itself, that project has caused massive inflation in WA, which has been the leading reason in my opinion, for why house prices the other leading reason from a supply cost in terms of why it costs double what it used to build the same house, because all those trades were being taken up by the government and not by building companies.
And I think, you know, from an outsider, so to speak, it is good to see investment in that level of transport infrastructure almost before it's needed. Getting ahead of the game, sort of, you know, my observations in Southeast Queensland, for example, is we're always building or delivering train lines years after they're needed. Whereas, you know, when you go to Perth, you don't fight a lot of traffic.
Don't ask a Perth person that, because they disagree with you, but I guess it's all relative.
Their version of traffic's different, I guess. I mean, I live 7 kilometres from my office, and my commute takes nearly 40 minutes in the car, takes me 15 minutes in the train. So, my limited experiences in Perth, I've barely experienced traffic.
40 minutes would be the time it takes to get from the outer reaches of Perth to the city by car.
Yeah. Yeah. And is there a migration or a change in habits onto that public infrastructure now that it's been delivered, or is Perth still a driving city as I've heard it described in the past?
Perth will always be a driving city because it's a bit of a chicken and egg thing. People don't like using transport because it's not very connected, and then it's sort of hard to invest in it because no one uses it. But, you know, yeah, I guess the bet by the government is that people will use it at some point, that they'll need to use it because the roads will get busier. Again, Perth's planning space, its urban space is just 20 years behind Brisbane and 20 years in front of Adelaide. And so if you remember what Brisbane was like 20 years ago, you probably didn't have to drive for 40 minutes to get 7 km down the road. And you probably didn't have as many people using the train. So I'm sure that in 20 years' time, Perth will have similar problems, and you'll have that many more people jumping on the train because they're sick of sitting in a car.
I guess the structural advantages that support to the Perth market maybe 5 to 10 years from now.
Structural advantages are... are really a combination of a few things. One, because we continue to have massive budget surpluses, we have massive amounts of money to spend on projects, and that's jobs. People come here from around the world for jobs, and because they come here, they need somewhere to live. And because they're coming here at the levels they are, and we don't seem to be able to get our act together from a productivity perspective to build for them, prices just keep rising. And so the locals benefit from it. The people who come here have to pay for it. And then I guess it's just a circular situation in that instance. Now, what are the downside risks? The downside risk really is if the state government and the mining industry find some structural weakness, then there's less money flowing from the top down. There's less jobs. There's less reason to be here. People might go back to where they came from, when that might be the East Coast. It might be New Zealand, for example. But there doesn't seem to be that reality for Perth. It's not the mining boom. We haven't benefited from a mining construction boom like we had 15 years ago. That didn't happen in the last 5 years. We've benefited from certainly from commodity prices and royalties that have hit the state. We've benefited from massive stamp duty transaction money as a government, which has flowed into infrastructure. But more importantly, we've simply just benefited from having a lot of jobs and a very tight unemployment situation. And that's just created, I guess, a flow-on effect to a wealth effect where not many people in Perth are doing it tough compared to what you would experience on the East Coast. There's always going to be people. We understand that. But relative to a place like Melbourne, where every street corner has got someone struggling, Perth is sort of a lucky city within a lucky country, at least for the last 6 years.
Well, I think we've painted a pretty good picture of what's been happening in Perth and what might happen in the future. So really appreciate getting a local expert on rather than us trying to tell people what's going on there, hear from someone that lives it and knows it. So really appreciate Trent for joining us on Smart Capital this month.
Thanks, Andrew. Lovely to have a chat, and good luck with your endeavours in WA.